For AntiWar.com and Chaos Radio in Austin, Texas, I'm Scott Horton, and this is Anti-War Radio. In late December, Ethiopia invaded Somalia with U.S. backing, with the stated objective of overthrowing the local Islamic Courts Union and installing the United Nations-created government in its place. This week has seen an escalation with attacks by American AC-130 gunships. Now ABC News is reporting that CIA and U.S. Special Forces teams are on the ground in Somalia with Ethiopian troops involved in, quote, numerous missions. To assist our understanding of the opening of this new front in the global war against radicalism and extremism and what it really means in the larger sense is William S. Lind. He's a military strategist and one of the originators of the theory of fourth-generation warfare. He's the director of the Center for Cultural Conservatism at the Free Congress Foundation. Their website is freecongress.org, and you can read his anti-war writings at antiwar.com/Lind. Welcome to the show, sir.
Thank you.
It's great to have you on here.
My pleasure.
Now, before we get straight into Somalia here, I think I'd really like to start with liberalism, conservatism, and American foreign policy. Most people would classify supporters and detractors of the war in simple left-right terms, liberal-conservative categories. And as an opponent of the war before it even started, and now an advocate of immediate withdrawal, you seem to defy these measures. Why is that?
True conservatives don't like foreign policy, much less military adventures. They do not see the United States as the world's policeman. Their idea of foreign policy is that it should be about United States' own interests, as those are fairly narrowly defined. Essentially, the conservative view of foreign policy is that of Senator Robert A. Taft from the early 1950s, who simply said we should not be crusading around the world. The notion of trying to bring democracy to other countries by invading them is Wilsonianism, which has always been considered correctly an opposite of conservatism. So it's not surprising that the principal conservative magazine, which I write for fairly regularly, The American Conservative, opposed this war in Iraq from before the time it began.
Well, but wouldn't most people say the traditional conservative magazine is National Review, which did support it in every sense?
National Review is no longer conservative. National Review is neocon. And here we have a problem, really, with terminology. The so-called neoconservatives are not conservatives at all. They are, in fact, anti-conservatives. They're Jacobins, which conservatism was really founded in the late 18th century to fight. The Jacobins, of course, were the radical party in the French Revolution, who believed that France should bring the rights of man to all of Europe by military force. In the end, even Robespierre said missionaries with bayonets are seldom welcome. The neocons' roots are Trotskyites. And, in fact, what they remain is Trotskyites who have replaced Marxism with, quote, democratic capitalism, unquote, as the key ideology, but still believe in world revolution. Unfortunately, they have taken over National Review, as they have taken over many institutions in the old conservative movement. So, as I said, really, the only conservative journal, genuinely conservative journal at this point, is The American Conservative.
Okay, well, for the average conservative Texan who's driving by in his truck and listening to this, who sees things basically the way TV portrays it, that liberal, leftist, dirty, hippie, socialist types are anti-war and conservatives support their president and support the troops and the mission, what do you say to them to make them understand?
I say that Bush, and many of them realize this, by the way, Bush isn't and never was a conservative. Not only are unnecessary foreign wars not conservative, not only is the attempt to bring democracy to every country in the world on U.S. bayonets not conservative, but record federal deficits are not conservative. Open borders and a winking at illegal immigration is certainly not conservative. This administration is the equivalent of the old Rockefeller Republicanism, which, of course, conservatism rose within the Republican Party in the 1960s to fight. So a great many Republicans and grassroots conservatives understand this. They realize this is not a conservative administration.
Now, at this late date, it's pretty clear that you were right all along about Iraq, and certainly all your friends and acquaintances know now, at least, that you were right. But I'm curious as to what degree you felt pressure from your friends and associates within the conservative movement at the onset of this war.
I felt none, because my conservative friends and associates are conservatives. They're not neocons. Again, real conservatives believe that the United States should only go to war for America's very real, specific, concrete interests, and when our own national security is at stake, which very clearly was never the case here. They're not into sending American troops to die in order to bring the benefits of democracy and free enterprise to other countries that don't want them.
I see. All right. Well, I don't have a problem with that. It makes perfect sense. But I guess I'd imagine that for the average listener, that this is kind of a surprising idea, that people like yourself, the director for the Center of Cultural Conservatism, and people like Pat Buchanan, and as you mentioned, the rest of the writers at the American Conservative Magazine, that you would be in opposition when the conventional wisdom defines this simply in left-right terms, and we're to just leave it at that.
Well, again, the problem is that the left-right division has been all messed up by the rise of the neocons, who are really on the left, but have been given a name that includes the word conservative. And that has caused a great deal of confusion.
Yeah, and positions within the Republican Party in high levels of power.
Yes, and again, the Republican Party is one thing, and the conservative movement is something very different. Much of the Washington conservative movement has been captured by the Republican Party and is now a wholly owned subsidiary. But grassroots conservatives know very well the difference between conservatism and the Republican Party.
Okay, now on to Somalia. Why is America supporting Ethiopia's war to install the so-called bad guys from the last time American forces were there during Black Hawk Down?
The United States, as usual, has been misled, kind of like the bull with the red flag, to think that any strongly Islamic government is necessarily somehow an arm of al-Qaeda. What the so-called Islamic courts were doing in Somalia is, for the first time in 20 years, they were bringing order to the country. The barricades in the streets went down. People could walk around Mogadishu again. They weren't terribly popular. Their strong Islamic position wasn't terribly popular with the Somalis, who were pretty easygoing. But the most basic requirement any people anywhere has is for order and personal safety. And for the first time, they had brought that. But we got misled by, again, the red flag to the bull. Someone said, oh, they're connected to al-Qaeda, they're controlled by al-Qaeda. So we have backed this Ethiopian invasion, which has again reduced Somalia to chaos.
I'm reminded of bin Laden's speech from October 2004, where he said, all I have to do is send two mujahideen with a piece of cloth upon which it is written al-Qaeda, and send them to the furthest point east, and you'll send all your generals and all your billions of dollars chasing after them until you are finally bled to death.
And that's exactly what's happened in Somalia. What very little legitimacy the internationally created Somali government that has now been put into Mogadishu has been undermined by the fact that now the United States is openly intervening militarily on behalf of that government. Washington can't grasp that what fourth generation war is about is primarily not something military, it's about a contest for legitimacy. And as we're seeing in Iraq, as we see in Afghanistan, any government that is installed and propped up by foreign troops automatically has no legitimacy.
Now, when you say fourth generation warfare, what does that mean?
It's actually the biggest change in war in about 350 years. For the first time since the Peace of Westphalia in 1648, all around the world, states are fighting not other states, which is what our military is designed to fight. We're designed to fight other armies and navies and air forces with uniforms and specialized equipment and so forth, pretty much like our own. For the first time, they find themselves, for the first time in several hundred years, they find themselves fighting non-state forces and almost everywhere losing. In the 19th century, early 20th century, the state in parts of the world had to fight non-state forces, but it was piece cake. Now, almost everywhere, the state is losing.
And it is surprising from the layman's point of view to see what amounts to, you know, a ragtag militia with AK-47s being able to rout the most powerful military in the world. How is that happening?
Well, first of all, because contrary to what Washington usually says, wars are very seldom determined by technology. The best book on that, by the way, is the Israeli military historian's Martin Van Creveld's book, Technology and War, and he makes the point, looking back through all of history, that very seldom has technology determined the outcome of a war. What is at the root, again, of what's going on here is that all over the world, including in the United States, more and more people are transferring their primary loyalty away from the state to a wide variety of other kinds of things, from races and ethnic groups, through gangs, to religions, ideologies, you name it. And the same people who are not very interested in fighting for the state, as we saw with the Iraqi army in the first phase of the invasion of Iraq, are very willing to fight hard for their new primary loyalties. And that's essentially a far larger and more powerful factor than any piece of gear.
As you say, it's a crisis of legitimacy. That's the question, is who do the people consent to be governed by, basically?
And to whom do they give their loyalty? War, as the great American military theorist Colonel John Boyd often said, is fought at three levels: the moral, the mental, and the physical. The physical level, where we focus, putting firepower on targets, is the weakest. The most powerful is the moral level. And that, again, is what's going on here with these transferences of loyalty.
Now, could it in fact be said that America used to be pretty good with the whole moral level thing?
We were so good at it that the most powerful weapon we had in World War I was Woodrow Wilson's 14 points, where he offered Germany, in effect, an honorable peace. Had that offer been made by Clemenceau or Lloyd George, the German people would have laughed and said, well, it's just propaganda. But because it was coming from the leader of the United States, they believed it, and that in turn was a major factor in Germany's defeat, because that defeat essentially came from the people rebelling and saying, we don't want more of this war. Of course, they quickly learned that it was propaganda, and instead they got the horrendous diktat of the Treaty of Versailles crammed down their throat. But the United States had built up such enormous moral capital that when an American president made an offer like Wilson's 14 points, even the enemy believed it.
And that was back in, you know, it had built up so much tremendous moral power. That was back in the 19-teens. That moral power even lasted through the Second World War and the Cold War, and I dare say even the 1990s, no?
It essentially lasted up through the Cold War, because it became more and more obvious to anyone except hardcore communists that communism was a terrible failure, that it was a horrible thing to live under, and that nobody wanted it taking over where they happened to live. We had a great opportunity when communism fell to return to our historic grand strategy, which was not to play the game of great power, but to relate to the rest of the world primarily through trade and by a force of example, not through diplomacy and military force. Unfortunately, we had built up what President Eisenhower warned us against, a military-industrial congressional complex, and his original speech included the phrase congressional, and his chief of staff, Sherman Adams, convinced him to take it out, that lives off playing the superpower game with a defense budget of $500 billion a year. That's the biggest honeypot in the world, and the politicians don't want to get their snouts out of it. So we decided to become a world empire, which is, again, the very opposite of what conservatives want. We want an American republic. And the result has been that now America's prestige worldwide is at its lowest ebb ever.
And during the Cold War, there was a lot of empire building there. But as long as it was in the name of protecting the rest of the world from communism, people more or less were willing to forgive the excesses of the Cold War once it was over. The moral legitimacy seemed to last into even the 1990s.
It did, but then again, this change in policy, and driven both by neoliberals as well as neocons, where we decided that we were going to exert worldwide hegemony and essentially tell everybody else in the world how they had to live and what they were going to do and enforce it with the U.S. military, not surprisingly, turned everybody against us. This is a very, very old story historically. What we've seen over and over is that any country that tries to establish hegemony, whether it's Spain in the 16th century or France in the 17th and 18th centuries or Germany or Russia in the 20th centuries, invariably pushes everybody else together in a coalition against them.
Now, are there any examples in history where the people controlling the state realize this and correct their error before it's too late?
Yes, there are certainly cases where countries have realized that they have made some horrendous blunders. Usually they have to get some extremely unpleasant lessons in the way of some lost wars, and have in effect gotten their acts together. France after 1870 is an example. And Britain's return to its historic policy of what it called splendid isolation after the Napoleonic Wars is an example. The problem is that what we seem to be doing is following much more the model of Spain in the 17th century. When that century opened, Spain was the great world power, the first true world power with a world-circling empire. It was so rich that when the Spanish Armada was defeated, King Philip simply built another one. In fact, he built three more. Spain in the 17th century goes from that enormous world power to a headlong plunge down the tube that lasts for three centuries. And it wasn't that they didn't know it was happening. They did. And there were lots of proposals for reform, some of which would have probably worked. But none of them could cut through the interests at court that lived off the decay. And that's Washington today. The interests in Washington live off the decay. And as somebody who has been in this city for more than 30 years, was Senate staff for 13 years, I don't see any forces today that are capable of cutting through the decay here.
Okay, now back to Somalia. The news reports say that the reason America has invaded is because there's three Al-Qaeda guys there.
Right, and there are undoubtedly three Al-Qaeda guys also working at 7-Elevens in North Jersey.
Right. At least linked to Al-Qaeda.
Exactly. This is, again, as we were talking earlier, not only the fact that we are misled like the bull with the red flag, but also that Washington has this notion that we can and should control everything that happens in the world, and that there should be no wars around the world that we aren't somehow part of. Unfortunately, again, all this does is make the very shaky Somali government's legitimacy even shakier.
I wonder, I saw the headlines, I was doing a little bit of research over the last week, from the Washington Post last summer, where the Islamic Courts Union was trying desperately to be friendly with the West. And I wonder, did America just refuse to accept their offer, or did we make friends with them and then stab them in the back already?
The Washington has been of two minds on this. Of course, the Islamic Courts Union itself is of many minds on many subjects. It's a coalition. There are still voices here that correctly say we need to be talking to the more moderate elements in the Islamic courts. If Somalia is not to be plunged into a fourth-generation war, that's going to require that coalition be split as much as possible. But essentially what we missed is the most important thing for us, the thing that makes life hardest for Al-Qaeda and similar organizations, is simply order. And in turn, the thing that they thrive in is a disordered statelessness. And the Islamic courts, for the first time in 20 years, were bringing order to Somalia. And now that's gone.
Now, in your article for antiwar.com, your most recent article, you basically describe what it would take for each side to end up winning this conflict.
Yes. And what it comes down to for the government, of course, is order. Starting with Mogadishu, we'll have to see if they're capable of bringing that. It's too early to tell. The first thing that the non-state forces of the Islamic courts had to do was, when the Ethiopians invaded, get out of the way. If they had stood and fought against a state, they would have been annihilated. This is Mao's old rule for guerrillas, that when the enemy advances, we retreat. They did that successfully. The challenge facing them now is whether they can organize a fourth-generation war, the kind of thing that we're seeing in Afghanistan and in Iraq, directed against us, against the Ethiopians or whatever other foreign troops come in to prop up this new government. The new government has essentially no real military of its own. It's just got the same kind of tribal militias that everybody has over there. So it's too early to tell where this is going to go, but history suggests that, again, that governments that are imposed by and depend on foreign troops don't tend to last.
Well, and initial reports would seem to back up that point of view. The Ethiopians have already said that they're not planning on staying for very long, and it seems like if the local so-called Islamist forces have been watching what's going on in Iraq, they know basically that all they have to do is not lose and continue, as you say, to basically not allow the new so-called government to install order.
Well, it's not as simple as you put it. In order to do those things, they have to do some things that are very difficult, particularly now that they are operating underground. They have to organize financing. The fighting in Iraq doesn't just happen. There's a tremendous amount of money on the other side, not nearly as much as on our side, but nonetheless, it costs money to wage war. And that's true for fourth-generation entities as well. So they have got to organize. They have got to make sure that their fighters are paid, supplied with materials, trained, coordinated. If we look at Iraq, what we saw virtually from the beginning, because we outlawed the Ba'ath Party, is that the Ba'ath provided a pre-existing organization like this. And the insurgency was built on that. So, whereas the government in Somalia is very weak, it's not clear that the Islamic courts, now driven underground, are very strong.
Right. So they may not be able to wage an effective insurgency at all.
They may not be able. It's a question of organizational ability, and to be blunt about it, cultures like Somalia don't tend to produce people with a lot of organizational ability. We'll just have to wait and see.
Now, I'm sure that this will sound like a silly question in this day and age, but under what authority did the president just invade Somalia?
Well, we haven't invaded. We have involved ourselves providing support to a faction in a civil war, and of course we've done that kind of thing almost since our republic's founding. If you think of the wars against the Barbary pirates, the undeclared war with France in the 1790s and so on. There is little question that this administration and previous administrations, if you think what the Clinton administration did in the Balkans, where we attacked a historic ally, Serbia, that had done absolutely nothing to us, and essentially killed about 5,000 Serbian civilians in a bombing campaign, that these administrations have tried to define the president's war-making power ever more broadly. Nonetheless, again, there are precedents for this kind of thing that go back to our earliest days.
Right. Now, according to ABC News, there are special forces and CIA guys with the Ethiopian troops. Does that not count? How many troops does it have to be before it's an invasion?
Well, that's hard to say, but an invasion usually means that you're actually coming ashore with combat troops, not simply providing some advisors and coordinators and so on, which I'm sure we are doing. This kind of sleight of hand involvement is something states have done for a long time. It's not the same thing as an invasion. Nonetheless, there's no question in my mind that this administration believes that the president alone, without any cooperation from Congress, has the right to invade Somalia or virtually any other place. We have seen administration after administration in effect trying to say that the Constitution gives war-making power solely to the president, which of course it does not.
Now, if it's all right, if I switch gears here a little bit, you recently wrote an article for the American Conservative called How to Lose an Army. And in this article, you refer to the war as Operation Provide Targets, which by last month's body count sounds about right, but that's still a long way from losing a whole army. How might America lose a whole army in Iraq?
What I talk about in the piece, I think it's December 15th, American Conservative, is what could happen if the United States or Israel attacks Iran. That's my great fear at this point. And if that happens, one of the Iranians' options, is to roll up our army in Iraq. The Iranians have said openly, this time we have 140,000 U.S. hostages, presumably soon to become 160,000 or 170,000. We have no field army today in Iraq. We are penny-packeted all over the place fighting insurgents. That's what you have to do to fight a guerrilla war. If the Iranians either cut our supply lines to the south by getting the cooperation of the Shiite militias in the south, virtually all of our supply lines come up from Kuwait, and those militias are in a position to cut those supply lines, or if they actually cross the border with, say, 4 to 6 regular divisions, or a combination of both, in my view, there is a possibility that we could lose the army we have in Iraq.
Now, if we just think of the geography, basically what we're talking about is the supply line that runs from Kuwait to the Green Zone in Baghdad is runs all through the Shiite part of Iraq, whose leaders are all backed by Iran.
That's correct. So a British journalist I know was talking with the head of Siri, which has the Badr Brigades, and the current Iraqi government essentially is Siri controlled. And he said, well, what if the U.S. attacks Iran? And the guy replied, then we will do our duty. So I think there is a fairly high probability that these militias, including, of course, al-Sadr's Mahdi army, which we've already fought twice, would respond to an Iranian request by moving to shut down the convoys. If we run out of fuel, we're stuck. American armies are enormously fuel thirsty, and if those fuel convoys are not coming constantly, we could run out of fuel very quickly. And of course, one might think, well, that's okay, Iraq is an oil-producing nation, there's got to be fuel everywhere. There isn't. Iraq has to actually import fuel at this point because its own refining capacity is so small.
Seymour Hersh quoted an intelligence source as saying that he thought that Iran could take Basra with 10 imams and a sound truck.
I think that there is a very good chance that it could. That, again, is Shiite country, and the militias, if they again respond to the Iranians they're allied with, remember that the most important Shiite cleric in Iraq, al-Sistani, is Iranian.
Right.
And in fact, he was recently offered Iraqi citizenship and turned it down, said, I was born an Iranian and I will die an Iranian. So I think there's a very good chance that whole Shiite area could blow up on us, and then where do the convoys come from?
Now, I don't understand why our American government is supporting the Iranians in Iraq while they're preparing to fight them in Iran. It seems like they would be trying to cozy back up to the Ba'athists and get behind Ba'athist lines or Sunni lines before the big stab in the back comes.
Well, this, of course, just shows how utterly strategically bizarre our invasion of Iraq was. The United States was allied with Saddam Hussein against Iran. We supported Iraq throughout the Iraq-Iran war. And that made strategic sense. We were looking for somebody to block Iranian expansion into the Persian Gulf. Well, geographically, the country best positioned to do that is Iraq. We had a regime there that was very anti-Iranian. It all made sense. Then suddenly we invaded Iraq, overthrew that regime, turned the Iraqi government over to what are in effect Iranian allies, and we have won the Iran-Iraq war for Iran.
Well, so now it's time to make that okay by doing a regime change in Iran, and then that way it's an America-friendly government in Iran that controls Iraq. So
well,
is that basically the reason here?
That's certainly what the neocons would like to see, but I don't think even the Bush administration, as detached from reality as it usually is, now has any illusions of an American ground invasion of Iran to overthrow the regime. What's being talked about is airstrikes on Iranian nuclear facilities. But there's no reason to think that the Iranians would respond symmetrically with just some missile and airstrikes of their own. Their advantage lies on the ground with us right next door.
Sure, and also in their contacts with Hamas and Hezbollah all over the world, too, right?
Yes, and we've just seen that Hezbollah, which has been Iranian-armed and Iranian-trained, happened to be rather good militarily. It defeated the Israelis. And that is a sign that an Iranian army isn't necessarily like an Arab army. I mean, Arab armies are crap, with the exception of the Jordanians. But Iran is not an Arab country. and an Iranian army may be a rather different beast to deal with.
All right, we're all out of time. I really appreciate you coming on the show today.
My pleasure.
Everybody, William S. Lind. He's the director of the Center for Cultural Conservatism at the Free Congress Foundation. And you can read his archives also at antiwar.com/Lind.